Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and today I'm joined by animation historian Jake S. Friedman, author of the books The Art of Blue Sky Studios, The Disney Afternoon, The Making of a Television Renaissance, and The Disney Revolt, The Great Labor War of Animation's Golden Age. This will be part one of a two-part conversation. Part two will air 2 weeks from today. Jake Friedman, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Hi, thank you. Good to be here.
So yeah, thanks for joining us today. You've written a number of books about animation history and consulted on other books and shows. I understand that you got your start as an animator yourself.
That's right. I went to NYU to study animation, graduated from the film and television program there, and I got my first gig working on a Disney television cartoon show called Little Einsteins. So my first credit was a Disney credit, and I can always have that as my badge of honor, I guess. And following that, I worked on a Nickelodeon show called Wonder Pets, and I worked on animation for Saturday Night Live, and I worked on a couple of feature films. All my work was out here on the East Coast. I never made it out west, never desired to live in Southern California.
Well, give us a little bit of historical background for your book, The Disney Revolt. The Great Depression hit at the end of 1929, then Franklin Roosevelt became president 3 years later. So Organized labor seemed to have a friend in the White House.
Yes, absolutely. Lots of people who are Disney aficionados, they know about how Walt called his top animators the Nine Old Men. And some of those Disney fans know that that phrase came from Roosevelt's term for the nine Supreme Court justices who he thought were old fogies and too old fashioned and were not changing with the times. And they were voting down his proposed bills for the New Deal, things that would employ Americans, things that would get people up and working again, ways to decrease the 25% unemployment rate in the country. It was a very progressive time. His Secretary of Labor, who was also the first Secretary of Labor, was the first woman on any presidential cabinet. And it was a time in which labor leaders were given a lot more power, but it was also a very convoluted time because there were a lot of unions that were coming up all at the same time, all vying for control over the same crafts and same jobs. So I focus in my book, The Disney Revolt, on Hollywood, right? So at the time there were like two or three unions trying to say that they, you know, controlled the actors. Now we have the Screen Actors Guild, but that was just one of several back then. There were several that were vying for control over the directors. And so not only were unions fighting against the moguls and management, but they were also fighting amongst each other. It was kind of like the Wild West in terms of unions back then. Rules were just sort of, you know, emerging as unions were emerging and as the National Labor Relations Act was coming into play. So at that time, because it was so uncodified, the mafia stepped in. You know, prohibition had just been repealed. Bootleg liquor was a thing of the past. They had to find a new way to make some bank. And Al Capone's gang saw that unions were new, coming up, and they thought of this really great idea. And the guy who I profile in The Disney Revolt is this really interesting, love to hate him type character named Willie Bioff, who was part of Capone's gang, and he vied to basically control all the unions in Hollywood one at a time, thinking that if you can control all of the, say, actors or projectionists, you can go to the moguls and threaten to go out on strike, basically blackmail them to write you a $500,000 check.
Now, Willie Bioff sounds like a cartoon name for a gangster, like Will He Buy Off Walt?
Well, yes, he came from, I think, Odessa. His name was Biofsky, and yes, his name is cartoonishly punny that his actual name was Willie Bioff, as it appeared in all the trades and in the New York Times and in all the papers.
Now, he had been a lieutenant for Al Capone back in the day.
Yeah, he was working independently on his own. Now we're going into the Capone stuff right now. We're taking a step away from the animation. I'm sure you have a lot of animation fans who want to know more about what Disney was doing back in the 30s and early 40s. But this guy was showing up on all the Variety articles. You open up Variety, you open up the Times, and you see articles about how Willie Bioff is trying to take over Hollywood unions. He started in Chicago with the projectionist unions, and in 1936, if I'm not mistaken, came down to Hollywood to basically expand his empire. It was a quote, open secret amongst all the craftspeople of Hollywood that he was basically blackmailing and running a racket. He was a racketeer. But there was nothing to arrest him for. They had no hardcore proof. He kept blaming communists and the communist influence for things running awry. He pointed fingers away from him whenever possible. And he was able to slip through the police time and time again until read the book to find out what happens with Willie Bioff.
Right. Now, IATSE, the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, is now a large and respectable union. But according to your book, in the 1930s and early 40s, it was run by Willie Bioff and another gangster, George Brown.
Yeah, George Brown didn't start off as a gangster. He was the head of the local union in Chicago. And then through Willie Bioff, kind of encouraging him, and through the Capone syndicate, George Brown was like, yeah, I'll run for head of all of IATSE and all of the nation. And, you know, Capone's gang made sure that he won the election. And so George Brown, who stayed in Chicago, he placed Willie Bioff as his lieutenant, you might say, in charge of Hollywood's IATSE branch. And so George Brown didn't have a history with being a wise guy. He was just kind of like roped into it. He saw that there was money to be made. Willie Bioff made a very convincing argument, and it seemed to be a foolproof plan. But really, it was Willie Bioff who went down with the ambition and with the Capone syndicate behind him.
Now, some rank and file union members might think you go a little hard on labor organizers in the Disney revolt, particularly when you talk about unions like the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World.
It was a crazy time back then. What can I say? I wanted to bring the first mention I have of the IWW starts out in the very beginning when we have the head of the Socialist Party named Eugene Debs. And once he lost the nomination for president, the Socialist Party kind of split into two different groups, and one became more radical and one became a little more conservative. And the more radical of those two groups sort of evolved, or at the time maybe devolved, into the IWW. And at the time, if you pick up old newspapers that report on the IWW, you see some like local terrorist stuff. They would put bed bugs in hotels. They would go to farms and throw wrenches in the machine and break the machines. They would light fields on fire. They were just like anti-capitalist wherever possible. And because they were Midwest based, young Walt Disney had an in-person experience with IWW. Anyone in Chicago would read about them in the newspaper. And when Walt Disney was 16 and working as a part-time mail delivery boy in the Chicago City Hall, there was a bombing that killed four people. And Walt himself was right in front of the exit when it happened. He reported, as an older man remembering it, that there was like dust flying everywhere. It was a big explosion. Like he was a witness to this thing. The culprit of this, it was called a death bomb at the time, was never found. But in the court of public opinion, people assumed it was the IWW. Why? Because the judge who had just condemned the head of the group, as well as 40 members of the group, was Kennesaw Mountain Landis. And he worked, his office was in that building.
To be fair, yeah, there was certainly violence on the part of some workers. But union organizers were often going up against campaigns of greater violence, not to mention spying, intimidation, and sabotage.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people were panicked because the Russian Revolution had just happened. And so there was a lot of fear that all these Russian immigrants that people assumed destroyed the government of Russia were coming in and they were going to destroy the government of the United States. That I haven't found any evidence that there was any actual threat, but it was something that gave a lot of people fuel for hate and xenophobia.
So you mentioned Eugene V. Debs, and early in the book, you talk about how Walt's father, Elias Disney, was actually a socialist organizer in the early 20th century. He was a follower of Eugene V. Debs.
Yep, he certainly was. Walt went on record to say that his father was a Debs man. Apparently, it wasn't too uncommon for people, especially poor people like Walt Disney's dad, who was a struggling carpenter his whole life and a struggling farmer, to be part of the Socialist Party and to be a Debs man. Eugene Debs was the party leader who was protesting World War I. He was saying this war is unnecessary. There's no reason why the U.S. should be involved. And he was arrested for sedition. All of the people who protested World War I, Woodrow Wilson said, this is a seditious act. This is traitorous. And they were all arrested. It was a very noble thing for someone to protest a war, particularly at that time.
So it's interesting that Walt later became such an avid red baiter starting in the 1930s. Accusing so many people of being communists, whether they were or not, usually not?
Well, I don't know when he started fearing communism. I think it was probably maybe at the end of the 30s and maybe at the beginning of the 40s. And, you know, just like today we have what we call right-wing media, they had that then. Our Fox News was their National Enquirer under William Randolph Hearst. There was a big newspaper and lots of articles and columns that were published all over the place.
So everybody was blaming the communists.
Everyone's blaming the communists. Everyone's blaming the communists. And my book has no evidence that there was any ill intent from any communist influence. I can't identify a single communist person who appears in my book, with the exception of Dave Hilberman, who was one layout artist, who was basically the secretary of the union that Babbitt was the leader of. I was able to identify no other communists in that book. So I really can't find any other malicious intent or any desire to overthrow the US government. It really illustrates how it became a witch hunt that Arthur Miller ended up making a whole play about, you know, but it begins here. It begins at the time of the Disney Revolt. It begins with the unions emerging in the 1930s and into the 40s.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And today we're bringing you part one of a two-part conversation with animation historian Jake S. Friedman, author of the books The Art of Blue Sky Studios, The Disney Afternoon, The Making of a Television Renaissance, and The Disney Revolt, The Great Labor War of Animation's Golden Age. Now, you mentioned the origin of the term nine old men, and a number of books have been written about Disney's nine old men, the animation directors of the Golden Age of Animation, legendary figures like Ollie Johnson, Milt Kahl, and Ward Kimball. But you write about the Disney artists who were on board before any of these guys, animators who really built the studio starting in the early 1920s. Ub Iwerks, Fred Moore, Norm Ferguson, Bill Tytla.
Dick Lundy as well.
Oh, Dick Lundy. And especially a fellow named Art Babbitt.
This is what the book is really about. So shame on me for making this conversation take as long as it did to mention Art Babbitt.
Well, of all the people that you profile in this book, two figures stand out: Walt Disney and Art Babbitt. Now, most people know a little bit about Walt Disney, but a lot of folks have never heard the name Art Babbitt.
Right. And I kind of wanted to change that. I at the time when I started this book, when the project was basically, when it landed in my lap in, I want to say 2007, I kind of knew a little bit about Art Babbitt. There was very little at the time that was written about him. And the reason why is because all books published by the Disney Publishing Company at the time didn't mention him. They mentioned the Nine Old Men. And all those animators that you named, and you know, this group of nine animators, that moniker was given to them in the 1948, I think the article came out, they called them the Nine Old Men, which was a joke because they were actually all nine young men. So it was Walt being cute. And then they grew up to actually be nine old men and, you know, living legends. But the reason why Walt called these nine animators who came after Art Babbitt and after Dick Lundy and after Norm Ferguson and after Fred Moore was because they were not only really talented animators, but they gave him something that he valued probably higher than anything else, loyalty. And you can see that he values loyalty if you look at the intro credits to Snow White, when he writes a thank you note to his staff and thanks them for their hard work and loyalty. So all the nine old men were artists who did not go on strike and stuck by Walt throughout that strike, which happened in May 1941, May through August 1941. And then you have folks like Bill Tytla, who was a Michelangelo of animation, who also went out on strike. And people like Norm Ferguson, who basically created Pluto, and Dick Lundy, who basically created Donald Duck, and Fred Moore, who basically created Mickey Mouse. Not created from scratch, but turned that wiry, ratty type of character into the round, lovable, cuddleable, appealing character, and basically the whole Disney appeal style that we know today. So Freddie Moore did not go on strike, but as he and Norm Ferguson and Dick Lundy built their careers at the studio, they were kind of butting heads a little bit with Walt. But this cohort of animators pre-Nine Old Men really created the cast of Disney characters, the family of like the Disney stalwart characters. Each one of them is responsible for basically codifying something else. And Art Babbitt is responsible for creating Goofy. And I say creating, these characters, their designs existed, maybe the voices existed, but what really gave them character is what these animators imbued into them, but really it codified their personality. So Art Babbitt, there was not much written about Art Babbitt when I decided to undergo this project. There was some stuff written in third-party books, but I wanted to understand more about what made him important. And as an animator, he developed Goofy. He was a hugely influential lead animator, just really good at his craft. He animated the Wicked Queen in Snow White and Geppetto in Pinocchio and the Dancing Mushrooms in Fantasia. So there's that. Okay, those are a very few number of people can lay claim to doing those things like the animators I just mentioned. But in addition to that, Art Babbitt, it was his idea to bring the art school into the Disney studio. He brought in a live model. He brought in an art teacher named Don Graham, and he basically created what became the Disney Art School, which is the reason why Disney animation of the 30s is so much more advanced than animation from any other studio at that time, the art school. Art Babbitt developed, he kind of liked expensive things. He grew up poor. Once he started being paid a lot, he started spending money on things. And one of them was a movie camera. And so he started making home movies and used those movies as live action reference. And today that's something that all animated films do. Stop motion, CG, and of course, hand-drawn stuff. Filming actors and then watching them and using their movements as inspiration, particularly useful if you're filming people who are dancers or otherwise knowledgeable in choreography or body movement, and you as an animator aren't. You want to watch someone who is and use that as inspiration, not tracing, but use it as inspiration. Art Babbitt did that. He was the first one to use live action reference. And in trying to get behind Goofy's personality, he was also a big reader. And at the time in the mid 30s, method acting started taking hold of Hollywood. People were reading Stanislavski's books on acting. And Babbitt took that information. He had two books on this, and he created a treatise on how to apply it to cartoon characters, which no one had done before. And all the while, up to that point, Walt kept saying, we need personality. We need to figure out how to put personality in our characters. No one knew how to do it. Art Babbitt figured out that if you create a character analysis, you can imbue a character with personality. And he wrote this treatise called Character Analysis of the Goof, which was a 2.5 page essay on who Goofy was, things that you would never see on screen, things that are just deep in his psyche, and how he would interact with people on an everyday basis if he did exist in real life.
You would call that a character Bible nowadays.
Yeah, I guess you would. So you can say Art Babbitt created the first character Bible. So in these ways, in all these monumental ways, I argue, and I think successfully, that Art Babbitt is the most important person in animation after Walt Disney in that entire decade in the 1930s.
In the 1920s and 30s, cartoons, they were increasingly popular. Animation studios were springing up on both coasts, but cartoons had always been short subjects, maybe 5 or 10 minutes long, that usually played in theaters before a feature film. Until Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs came along in 1937, the idea of an animated feature film seemed absurd. And really, it would have been absurd without Art Babbitt. This is the point in time. This is 4 years before the strike that you mention in the book. And IATSE, the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, they're making advances at Disney employees. And it's actually Art Babbitt who suggests kind of an in-house a company union. Well, it's not a company union at the time. He advocated for what was called the Federation of Screen Cartoonists.
Well, union action at Disney right before Snow White premiered happened in reaction to a news article in Time magazine that reported on how Willie Bioff, who everyone loves to hate now, was coming to California to organize the Hollywood craft unions into his racketeering scheme. And this article came to Art Babbitt's attention. And this is just like 2.5 weeks before Snow White premieres. So everyone is feeling kind of nervous. No one really knows if Snow White is going to be the success that everyone hopes it is. And everyone, including Babbitt and Walt, thinks that there is a chance that the studio can go under because everything was put into this project. It was a big gamble. So the idea that Bioff would come in as well, that was just more than anyone wanted to handle. So Art Babbitt sees this in this article, takes the article to Roy Disney, who is Walt's brother and the CEO of the company. And he says, we got to do something. And Roy points Art to the vice president, you know, right below Roy, a man named Gunther Lessing. And Gunther Lessing is and was a very important player in the Disney company. And not a lot has been written about him, but at least at this point in the company, Gunther Lessing had Walt's ear and he had his own idea of how to run the company and kind of keep people in line. He's kind of like Jafar in that he knows how to manipulate people to protect his own skin and make himself look better and bigger. And he's just out for his own ends. So this Jafar type of figure, Gunther Lessing, he suggests to Art, how about we co-organize together a loosely knit social group. And we'll use that to block any sort of IATSE, any sort of Willie Bioff attempt. He's not saying, let's form a union. He's not saying, let's form an independent union. Let's form a company union. But this is the beginning of what becomes a company union, which is highly illegal. Management is forbidden from being involved in any sort of thing that is union-based. So eventually, this union becomes a real union, but still only made up of Disney employees, which makes it a company union, which is also bogus. A company union is still strapped and hogtied by what it can do. It's only an independent union, something that goes from company to company, that organizes crafts as a whole, that can really get anything done.
So at the end of the 30s, end of the 1930s, and this is right around the time of Snow White coming out as the first animated feature, there's this sudden growth of this independent union, the Screen Cartoonists Guild. They've organized animators at Walter Lantz Productions, Warner Brothers, and now they got their sights set on Disney because there's this in-house social group, the Federation of Screen Cartoonists, but they've been toothless. And now here it is. It's the Screen Cartoonists Guild versus the Federation of Screen Cartoonists.
Right. Right. They, for shorthand, they call them the Federation, who are basically like loyal to Walt. And you have the Guild, which was loyal to this independent big union. And the Guild had already organized every other animation studio in Hollywood. Disney was the only one. And on that very topic, animators were the only craft that did not have a union in Hollywood until then. So animators were the last of the crafts, and Disney was the last of the animators. So it was this like island of non-unionists that Disney desperately tried to hold on to. It's kind of absurd to think of it now, how desperately the studio wanted to keep their artists non-union, or at least non-independent union.
Another one of your quotes is that Hollywood culture in early 1941 was a tenuous balance of glitz and social upset.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of what was happening at the time. Because these unions were being formed, there was more and more demand for the same thing unions are fighting for now. Fair wages, sensible working hours, sometimes screen credits for people who, you know, deserve screen credit for their film. And it became kind of like a lasting legacy, because I think today Hollywood might be like the last stronghold of union pride. No one is going to point to SAG members and say, oh, you're a communist. And at the time, it was just something that they demanded as fairness. There were a lot of actors at the time who had a heyday in the 30s and were struggling in the 40s. I don't put this in the book, but you know, like the Three Stooges or the Marx Brothers, for instance, were really hurting for cash. Like Mo Howard, Mo from the Three Stooges, had become like a delivery boy by the 40s or 50s. None of these folks were, these actors, were receiving any sort of residuals, any sort of residual check for the work that was being played and replayed over and over, and that had eventually been sold to television. Joining a union was a great way to not just protect your income, but also protect your job.
You've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And today we've been bringing you part one of a two-part conversation with animation historian Jake S. Friedman. Jake is the author of the books The Art of Blue Sky Studios, The Disney Afternoon, The Making of a Television Renaissance, and The Disney Revolt, The Great Labor War of Animation's Golden Age. Part two of this conversation will air 2 weeks from today. In the meantime, you can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. Be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.
Like a boat out of the blue, fate steps in and sees you through. One reach upon a star, you're dreaming.